dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to the Frank Gaffney Show, Hour 3. We are going to be talking in this important segment of the program with several of the folks who I think are doing indispensably important work. Peter Pham, a man we turn to frequently for insights about Africa, is first up. He'll be giving us a sense of what's going on in Cote d'Ivoire and in Libya and what it means for you. Gal Luft will be talking to us about the president's so-called energy security strategy. What's wrong with it? What we should be doing instead? Congressman Buck McKeon, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, provides a sense of the Congress, if you will, of this war in Libya and the folly of defense budget cuts now in the offing. And Bill Gertz, our esteemed colleague from the Washington Times, tells us about the view from inside the ring of China, Libya, and much, much more. All of that is coming up in this installment of The Frank Gaffney Show, Secure Freedom Radio. But first up, Peter Pham. Delighted to have you back with us. Thank you so much for joining us. My word, there's an awful lot going on in your part of the planet, Africa most especially. Let's visit first and foremost about the Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire, as it's also been known. There seems to be a denouement, as the French might also say, in the works as we speak. Tell us, What is going on here between a president who no longer has a mandate and a president who claims to have one and the international community being involved? What are the stakes, especially for us, in how this turns out?
Well, what's at stake for us on the very short term, crass commercial side, Cote d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast, produces 40% of the world's cocoa. It's been a major source of the prices in recent weeks have soared to levels not seen in decades in both real and nominal terms because of conflict in the country. On a more broader and I think deeper level, what we're seeing here is actually the takeover essentially of by former rebels of a country, and one that is very critical in our region. It used to be a region that was predominantly stable. It was the anchor of French West Africa and really of Western policy during the Cold War, and it's now being taken over by rebels, which we don't know that much about.
Let me ask you this, Peter Pham, and you are, of course, the director of the Michael Ansari Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, a new post. Congratulations. One of the subtexts to this struggle that you almost never hear about is that the incoming would-be president, a fellow by the name of Alassane Ouattara, has a Muslim background, Muslim agenda. The outgoing, presumably, President Laurent Gbagbo has been resisting this, and apparently the election turned on people who voted for Ouattara who were not perhaps legitimately entitled to under Cote d'Ivoirean law, but nonetheless have given this mandate, which the international community is all behind, to a fellow who may well turn this into a if not a Sharia state, certainly one that is much more closely aligned with those who do adhere to Sharia. Is that in fact in play, and what, again, would the implications be for us?
It's certainly a fact, has been a factor in the Civil War, but it's much more complex. It's a deep ethnic divide. For example, the leader of the former rebels who are now actually rebranding themselves as the Republican forces who've taken control of most of the country. The leader is a young man by the name of Guillaume Soro, and he's actually a Roman Catholic. So it's much more complex. There is certainly that religion is a proxy in the fight, but it's a much more complex fight over resources and really over the identity of the nation. Is it a nation that looks outward to the West, or is it one that looks predominantly inward inland to Africa, to parts that, as you mentioned, are predominantly Muslim. And I think that's a big part of the issue. And the international community, I think, really dropped the ball on this several years ago when it endorsed a peace accord, then sent in a crony of the UN Secretary General who wasn't qualified for the job. He didn't carry out all the provisions of the peace accord, as you mentioned, about registration, validation of citizenship, et cetera, but held an election anyway. And this what we have is the result.
And again, Peter, just to cut to the chase here, for us, you know, the question of whether we get access to 40% of the world's cocoa or not, or perhaps oil that may well be there in abundance as well, I'm told, what would the implications be for the United States, for our interests in that part of the world, were the international community's favorite, this fellow Ouattara, actually wind up seizing power, taking power, obtaining power, however you want to put it, in the days ahead?
Well, I think what we have would be, I think the far bigger picture is the precedent set where the United Nations essentially went in with a special representative from the UN Secretary General and ran amok with the internal domestic legislation, constitution of the country, did so for a number of years, and basically essentially engineered the result they wanted. And the Security Council really dropped the ball. And I would say, to be perfectly fair, dropped the ball in this administration, and it dropped the ball in the last administration, because the man who ran this whole operation for the UN was appointed during the Bush administration, and no one at the Security Council said, wait a minute, this guy is not qualified for the job. He's a crony of the Secretary General, and what is he doing?
Yeah, very worrying indeed. We're talking with Dr. Peter Pham, currently a senior advisor to us here at Secure Freedom Radio on matters involving Africa. He is also the director of the Ansari Center at the Atlantic Council, specializing in Africa. He has written extensively on Africa and related issues. And, Peter, I guess I want to turn to another one north of the Sahara, one of the other countries in Africa, I should say, north of the Sahara, namely Libya, to get your take on what's going on there at the moment. We're hearing a lot about rebels. You mentioned this term, Republicans, a lot of rebranding going on, on these among these characters. Do you have a clear idea as to who the rebels are and what the implications would be should they, in fact, succeed in removing a man we all would love to see gone, Muammar Gaddafi?
Well, it's pretty clear that whatever, irrespective of whatever front the rebels in Libya put forward or whatever spokesman, that many of them are at the very least sympathetic to political Islamism, and many of them probably are also political Islamists, if not Salafists. The part of Libya where the rebellion broke out has always been a heartland of that. People forget or didn't pay attention that the largest demonstration that took place in that eastern part of Libya before the current uprising was May 2009 in a town that we've heard about in the news recently, Abjabia, and it was for the funeral of a man who was al-Qaeda's chief trainer, a guy named who went by the name of Ibn Sheikh al-Libi, captured by the Pakistanis, turned over to us. We had him and then turned him over to rendered him to the Egyptians. The Egyptians eventually handed him to Gaddafi, and he died in a Libyan prison. It was the largest demonstration, was actually a sympathy march and a funeral for this man. And also, I would point out that in addition to the Islamism there, we're paying a lot of attention to what's going on, the seesaw back and forth, who's taking the initiative on the coast. Largely abandoned in all this is what's happening in southern Libya. Gaddafi's pulled all his forces up north to fight the rebels. The rebels are fighting them there. And the south is left untended. And al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, the local al-Qaeda franchise, has been moving very rapidly into those areas. And so I think at the end of the day, irrespective of what conclusion we arrive at in the coming weeks, I think the radical Islamism terrorists will have gained a foothold, whether it be in the new Libyan government, if there's a new one, or simply in the southern part of the country. There has been a shift, and it's not a favorable one.
Yeah, and as you know so well, that will attend not only the problem of this immediate issue of the terrorists taking hold in Libya, but also refugee flows in all likelihood into neighboring states that are totally ill-equipped to deal with them. And we never got to Sudan at all, where there's a high drama as well. We'll have you back hopefully very soon, Peter Pham. Thank you very much for joining us and for these sobering insights into parts of the world that we better be paying much more attention to before they bite us in the proverbial butt. Thank you, Peter. Next up, Gal Luft will be talking to us about the president's so-called energy security strategy. What's wrong with it? What we should be doing instead.
First line of defense in the war of ideas. Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any of the junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. Now, I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Michael Medved is asking Congress to simplify the corporate tax code for good reason.
This is a real problem. Of the 500 top Fortune companies, nearly 100 pay no taxes because they use various dodges
that have been written into the law by lobbyists.
And the President of the United States and Paul Ryan, the House Budget Chair,
and John Boehner, the Speaker of the House,
everybody ought to work together to get rid of this stuff.
It's just wrong.
The Michael Medved Show. Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. We are going to be waging the war of ideas here with several of our distinguished colleagues who are in the front lines of the fight on a number of different fronts. It is an extraordinary time. Every day, something else is popping up that requires our attention, so we're quickly going to talk with Gal Luft about the president's speech on energy security. He is a go-to guy on this, and I wish the president had gone to him. I sense he did not. Then Roger Noriega will be talking with us about Hugo Chavez and the threats he is helping to metastasize in our front yard in Latin America, including some that will just knock your socks off, involving terrorism organizations. Doug Feith will be joining us to talk about the Libya campaign and the mutation by the Obama administration of America's treaty-making procedures with some quite serious and ominous implications. And finally, we'll be visiting with Sarah Carter of the Washington Examiner. She'll be telling us how this Libya campaign is playing out as far as the United States military is concerned. And we'll get into a couple of other issues with her as well involving our forces, their morale, and their capacity to defend us, as we require them to do. But first, we'll be joined by Gal Luft from the Institute for the Assessment of Global Security. He is its executive director and one of the really most serious, thoughtful people on energy security I have had the pleasure to know. He co-authored with his colleague at IAGS, Ann Koren, Turning Oil into Salt. Required reading if you want to know what we could be doing about the kinds of problems President Obama addressed in his speech yesterday. And I wanted to ask you, first off, Gal Luft, what did the president say about energy security yesterday? And what did you make of his suggestions about what to do about it?
He basically said what every president since Richard Nixon has said, you know, about the need to reduce our dependence on oil, blah, blah, you know, presenting essentially the same ideas of increasing our efficiency, vehicles. He was a little bit more positive on the domestic drilling front, and I think that has a lot to do with the fact that the timing of the speech, as we approach the first anniversary of the BP Gulf spill, the Deepwater Horizon incident, and he knows that he will be criticized for the unwanted moratorium on offshore drilling. That coupled with the fact that gas prices are increasing due to the instability in the Middle East. So I think it was mainly a preemptive act on his behalf to indicate to American voters and to Congress that he's on the case. But in terms of the message, I found it to be quite disappointing because I don't think, from what is reflected in the speech, that he really understands what the problem is about. The problem is not our dependence on imported oil. The problem is oil's virtual monopoly over transportation fuel. I think this is a very important distinction that is not well understood in our country.
Well, explain. Because, we're talking with Gal Luft of the Institute for the Assessment of Global Security. Tell us what that distinction is, because I suspect to most people's minds, you talk about the importing of oil. It is understood that that oil goes into our transportation sector. But what is the distinction that you're drawing, and why? What are the policy implications of that distinction, Gal?
Well, if the only thing you care about is imported oil, then all you have to do is basically drill, 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 and not import any oil. Okay? But the question is that going to solve our problem? Of course it won't, because we will still be vulnerable to supply disruptions, supply shocks, and price shocks, just like a lot of other countries in the world that don't import any oil, but when global oil prices go up, they pay more. So, you know, we had gasoline and diesel demonstrations in Great Britain when Great Britain was still energy independent. So the notion that we can insulate ourselves from the rest of the world by being self-sufficient in oil ignores the reality that oil is a fungible commodity.
Especially, as you have pointed out, Gal, that is especially true insofar as OPEC's historic practice of cutting back on their production when we increase ours, all designed, I guess, to manipulate those oil prices for precisely this purpose. So, again, if indeed there is a distinction here, and I certainly accept that there is, what is it that we could be and should be doing about oil being the dominant fuel for our transportation sector that could change this sort of strategic position we find ourselves in of financing the people who are trying to destroy us, these particularly these Sharia adherent types?
We have to allow oil to compete against other sources of energy on board our cars and trucks. We have to allow fuel competition, because if we have cars that can run only on oil and nothing but oil, then we will always have to pay as much as the owners of the oil charge us. and as much as the world market dictates.
So, Gal,
if you have a car that, that allows you fuel competition, if you have a car that you can pour oil, but it can pour in something other than oil, like, for example, methanol can be made from natural gas. You know, we have a lot of natural gas. And the president himself said so, that we have an abundance of natural gas at the moment. And so let's put gas to work and turn it into methanol. The spot price of methanol is, last time I checked, was $1.25 per gallon.
Gal, this sounds very appealing, needless to say. And the president, I think, made reference to the desirability of having more natural gas-powered vehicles. Is that what he has in mind? And if not, what does it take to make cars, what I think of as omnivores, capable of burning ethanol or methanol or gasoline or some combination of the three?
Well, it's very easy. You have to make them flex fuel. If a car is a flex fuel, then the driver decides how much of each goes in. The driver decides he wants to run the car methanol or ethanol or gasoline or any combination of the three. And the economics of the day will dictate our consumer choices. But if the car is not flex fuel, then we cannot enjoy the privilege of choice.
Okay. So the flex fuel vehicle, Galluft, is a present technology in place on our roads today. What would it take to get us from where we are right now to having these be widely available to the consumer so that this kind of fuel choice, as you put it, is also widely available and enough to make a difference in terms of our strategic situation vis-a-vis OPEC?
What it takes is congressional action. We need an open fuel standard. We need the Congress to essentially decide that cars sold in the United States must offer a fuel choice. And since we're talking about a policy that does not require incentives or tax breaks or any of those things that we don't have the money to fund at the moment, and we're talking about $100 per car, per new car. That is the extra cost involved with something like this. So it's really, really a low hanging fruit, and I'm very disappointed that the president did not pick this up and spoke about a lot of things that are very important and are needed as well. There's a lot of good stuff in the speech too, but I think that the lowest hanging fruit and the policy that could make the most difference was not included.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Yeah, we're going to have to leave it at that. I trust that your leadership and that of IAGS will hopefully enable the Congress to see the wisdom of adding this kind of ingredient into the mix of energy security and thereby move us from our present intolerable posture to one where we are not only much more energy independent, but able to break the back of OPEC. Gal, thanks so much for joining us for this assessment of the president's speech. Keep up the great work, and we'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we have Congressman Buck McKeon giving us his insights from the House Armed Services Committee on what the devil's going on in Libya with our defense programs.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fastballing philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
What are you doing?
Filling out a loan application.
I can help you get approved, you know.
Really? How?
With this.
A bag of sand?
It's not a bag, it's a pouch. And it's not sand, it's credit fairy dust.
Credit fairy dust?
Yes, I sprinkle some fairy dust on the application, and your credit rating magically improves.
There's no such thing as the credit fairy.
An unbeliever now. But what will you think when your loan is approved?
I'll think my credit score improved because I paid my bills on time, kept my credit card balances low, and only opened a new card if I really needed it.
It's the dust.
It's sand.
Don't deny the credit fairy.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Congressman Buck McKeon of California. He has been representing the 25th district of that state for years now and has become, I think, really one of the most important figures on Capitol Hill at the moment when it comes to national security matters. And, Mr. Chairman, it is terrific to have you with us to talk about a very busy and, I guess, increasingly momentous portfolio that is before the Armed Services Committee at the moment. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Let's start. You had a hearing just yesterday with the senior civilian and military leaders of the United States Armed Forces, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mike Mullen, on Libya. I know you've expressed concerns about this operation, as have quite a number of your colleagues. Give us your sense of that hearing and where you think we are in this campaign.
Well, from the respect of the hearing, it's kind of like we're all over the board. The members on both sides of the aisle had concerns, and then there were some members that that are very comfortable with the humanitarian role that we're playing. My concern on this thing was a week ago. Well, actually, I guess now 2 weeks ago. Today, or Thursday, on St. Patrick's Day, we had a St. Patrick's Day lunch in the Capitol. And the president was there, the vice president was there, the speaker, the prime minister from Ireland. We do this every year on St. Patrick's Day. The speaker and the president sat next to each other for lunch for an hour and a half, and no mention of Libya. Congress left that afternoon to return to district for district work period. The next morning at about 9, 10 o'clock, I received a message that the president wanted to have a meeting in the White House at noon. Well, most of the members had left town. It would have been good if he'd talked to the speaker the day before. Anyway, we got on a conference call. The president told us what he was going to do. I didn't realize it was going to be quite as large an effort as it turned out to be. The secretary said yesterday that the first 10 days we've spent about $550 million in this effort. And we've sent almost 200 cruise missiles. Not too long ago, they were talking about shutting down the line because we had all the cruise missiles we needed. The year's production is about 165, and we probably used now almost 200. So obviously, we're going to have to keep that line open and try to replenish the stock that we've expended there.
Yeah. Can I ask you about an idea that appears to be animating all of this, namely something called the responsibility to protect? I don't know how much it featured in your hearing yesterday or your conversations with the president or his senior subordinates, but what do you make of this idea that we are being volunteered, as the president said down in El Salvador, to take on missions at the behest of various multilateral organizations and that we have some sort of responsibility to do it, whether it's consistent with our national security or not?
Well, that was a concern that came up many times in the hearing yesterday. How do you pick and choose who you go help? I mean, we're not doing anything in Bahrain or Saudi Arabia or Yemen, or we didn't do anything in the Sudan. And yet, all of a sudden, this is very important. They say it's in our national security interest. The only thing I could get out of that 2.5 hours in the hearing yesterday and a secret briefing that we had the day before was it seems to me they were thinking that if we did not intervene, and if Gaddafi were able to freely kill many of his own people, that we would not be looked upon well by the national community. And I guess they figured that is the interest, the national interest that they're talking about. It's a different definition than I've ever heard of in the past.
Yeah, I dare say. And you could well find yourself investing enormous amounts of resources in trying to make ourselves look good all over the world. And in the process, as you know so well, Congressman Buck McKeon, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, squandering the resources that we have. Your comment about the Tomahawk line is a perfect example. This is a limited pool of resources and personnel and assets and so on. Let me ask you another question, if I may, Congressman, before we switch gears here a little bit. The rebels, what are the administration officials, representatives telling you, and what do you make of what they're telling you about the people we're now apparently increasingly, not just with airstrikes and air cover, but actually with boots on the ground, in a manner of speaking, as we'll be talking about with Bill Gertz shortly, CIA personnel, special operations personnel, helping these so-called rebels in Libya. Who are these guys?
I don't know how many times it was reiterated in the hearing, in the briefing, the secret briefing Wednesday, and in the open hearing yesterday, but Secretary Gates and Chairman Mullen over and over reiterated there are no boots on the ground. We have no people on the ground in Libya. Now, you know, that's what they said. It's on the record over and over.
That's their line, and they're sticking to it, huh?
Right. and I mean, even specific answers, because there were reports that we had special ops people on the ground that were air traffic controllers, that were, you know, people that were setting the targets on the ground for these cruise missiles and other attacks.
Right.
They specifically denied that, said we didn't have people there. So, you know, at this point, I have to take them at their word.
But is it any clearer who the people are that we're helping, if not with, in fact, boots or loafers or whatever you want to call them on the ground, certainly with these airstrikes, the rebels' character and purposes, is that clear to you and your colleagues at this point, do you say?
Also, they kept telling us over and over that they didn't really have any specific leaders they were dealing with there. In fact, the secretary went on to say it's less what we know about the opponents than what we know about Gaddafi. And he said Gaddafi is responsible for killing more Americans than anyone other than Osama bin Laden.
Yeah. Well, and, look, I think one can agree he should go. The question is, the devil you don't know may be pretty awful, too. Congressman, right. We've only got about a minute and a half left, and I know you've got to go do some votes here. Let me ask you very quickly, what is your sense of the mood of the House at the moment as this new campaign gets underway against the backdrop of other wars we're involved in with respect to defense spending cuts?
You know, I was talking to a friend of mine on the Budget Committee last night. He said, there have been people that have come in that have proposed eliminating the F-35, cutting back to 250 ships. There have been such drastic cuts proposed for defense. I don't know. Hopefully we have enough rational people that understand that this is not a safe world that we live in. And since 1990 to now, we have cut our Air Force, our Army, our Navy, and you just can't keep doing that, especially when we see North Korea, Iran, China, other hotspots and potential hotspots nobody even knew about, Libya, couple of weeks ago, and now
right.
We've already spent
our friend, our ally,
there.
Muammar Gaddafi.
Yeah.
No, this is so absolutely vital, and we appreciate Congressman Buck McKeon, your chairmanship of the House Armed Services Committee, your leadership in trying to make sure that your colleagues do understand that in time of war, most especially, this is madness, an invitation to emboldening our enemies and greatly intensifying the danger to all of us. We thank you for your leadership, sir. I know you've got to get back to your day job. We appreciate you taking some time with us here at Secure Freedom Radio, and please,
Frank,
whatever you do, keep up the great work.
What we need to remember is Reagan said we never in his lifetime got into a war because we were overprepared.
Amen.
Always underprepared.
Amen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. God bless. We'll talk with you again soon, I hope. Next up, Bill Gertz with a view from inside the ring.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It is with sound mind and body that I, James Fredericks III, after fighting with all direct family members for decades, leave my entire fortune of $32 million to the one friend I had in the end, the package delivery guy, Matt Songer.
I had a feeling about this. I'm rich! Oh, this cannot be happening.
Actually, it's not happening.
What?
And it never will.
I don't get it.
There aren't even people here. That's just one of those murmuring sound effects.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to have money in your future, don't rely on luck.
Huh.
Put $10 away each month. Cook once in a while instead of eating out.
Okay.
Pay down your high-interest credit card.
Right.
Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow.
So, no inheritance?
No. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
And just to be clear, no inheritance, right?
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is there an epidemic in Washington? Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as ever by our friend Bill Gertz, the geopolitics editor of the Washington Times, also author of a superb must-read column in the Washington Times entitled Inside the Ring. He brings us his insights from inside the famous Pentagon ring, E-Ring, I presume, each week. And, Bill, we're always glad to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
You talked about several things of real interest in the Inside the Ring column this week, and I'd like to touch on several of them, Bill. Taiwan. Arms sales to Taiwan has been a perennial problem between the United States and Communist China. What's the Obama administration doing in this regard at the moment?
Well, basically, I spoke with a number of officials both on Capitol Hill and in the administration, and it appears the administration is not following the Taiwan Relations Act, which by law requires the administration to provide defensive arms. What I've uncovered is the fact that a vitally needed aircraft upgrade package for the island is being held up by the State Department, which is afraid to again upset relations with the Chinese military. Basically, the Taiwanese need upgrades for their F-16s. These include missiles, avionics. You know, the jets were purchased back in the 80s, and Along with that is also a air power study that was required under the 2010 Defense Authorization Act. It's law, was required to show what's going on with the balance of air power between China and Taiwan. And the bad news there is that it's shifting sharply in China's favor. So the administration's holding up this report and holding up the arms package, and people on the Hill are starting to get upset about it, which is good.
Yeah, indeed they should. Interestingly enough, as you report in your column, a woman by the name of Samantha Power, about whom we'll speak in a moment in connection with Libya, has begun expressing considerable concern about China's misbehavior in another area, the abuse of human rights. And you have a wonderful quote in your piece from her about the need to, quote, help bend the famous arch of history toward justice, unquote. And I'm not quite sure how she intends to do that, Bill, but she seems to be trying in that regard to be promoting this idea of quote, a responsibility to protect, unquote, which I gather has driven us in part in our present decision to become embroiled in this this Libyan debacle. Tell us about this woman, Samantha Power, what she's up to both in the Chinese and more importantly at the moment in the Libyan context.
Yeah, she's a reporter turned anti-genocide activist who is now on the National Security Council staff. She's basically one of President Obama's key advisors. And she, in her remarks in a speech in New York last week, basically highlighted this the kind of duplicity in the Obama administration's human rights policy, at least from my perspective. I mean, basically, here you have the administration launching humanitarian military intervention in Libya. And yet, when it comes to China, she said, yeah, we're stepping up our diplomatic protests, but there were no plans to cut off security or economic talks with the Chinese. And, you know, this is the real issue, and it kind of highlights the fact that the Chinese have no problem cutting off military ties with the Pentagon when they don't like something about the U.S., but to avoid offending the communists in Beijing, the U.S. will limit itself to just making noise about this massive human rights crackdown that's underway. Chinese are trying to prevent the spread of the movement towards democracy in the Middle East going to China.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the movement towards democracy in the Middle East, Bill, and in fact, whether there's much likelihood that it will result in that. That may be the aspiration of some of those who have started it. But specifically, just to drill down on Libya for a moment, Bill, Samantha Power has, as I indicated, been promoting this idea in connection, as you say, with her humanitarian activism, that the United States and other nations have a responsibility to protect, that is, to become involved in incidents where genocide or other human rights abuses are taking place on a large scale. It's always selectively applied. At the moment, it really does seem to have generated much of the impetus behind getting us into Libya. Bill, you're a ace national security reporter. You've got terrific sources in the Pentagon. What are you hearing about how this is going in Libya at the moment? Do they understand inside the ring why we are there, what we are trying to do there, and what the prospects of succeeding are?
They're trying to deal with a very difficult situation. You know, the military likes very clearly to be defined mission objectives. What's the goal? When do you reach it? How do you get out of it? And what we have in Libya is kind of a very vague mission. Again, it was, you know, we had a great piece in the paper by retired General Mark Kemet, who said that it's turned traditional use of military power on its head. It used to be that you exhausted all of the diplomatic, economic, and other options in advance, and then you launched military action. This was just the opposite. They launched military action without having a real clear political objective and strategy, and now we're trying to oust the regime without really saying that that's the objective.
Yeah, or without necessarily applying the resources necessary to do so. Which brings us all to this question. You had a piece in the paper this week about the defection of the foreign minister of Libya, Moussa Koussa. Tell us what that portends, if anything.
Very significant, very significant. He is the key Gaddafi henchman. And definitely someone that should be prosecuted under U.S. law for terrorism. He was the mastermind behind the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, which killed 270 people. Later on, he was the leader of Gaddafi's nuclear program, as well as his other WMD programs. And his defection is very significant in the sense that it will provide an intelligence windfall on the covert supplier networks that are being used today, in addition to the ones of from the Pakistani network headed by AQ Khan. This guy has access to information about the Iranian supplier networks, the Syrian supplier networks, the North Korean networks. So this could be a potential windfall. The Brits, he obviously didn't affect the U.S. because he definitely would have been prosecuted. He has close relations with the British intelligence. So this is still an unfolding story to see how they're going to deal with the Lockerbie terrorist, the crime that he was responsible for.
Yeah, having the Brits having, in effect, kind of whitewashed the thing in the end by allowing the man that was said to be the man responsible, in fact, I think a fall guy for
right.
Muammar Gaddafi, letting him out of the Scottish prison as part of their effort to, you know, restart or reset, if you will, economic relations with Libya. Bill Gertz, assuming Moussa Koussa does, in fact, know an awful lot about where the proverbial bodies are buried inside the regime, and presumably also would know a lot about who the opposition to the regime is at the moment. Do you think it will make a material difference in what we do about Gaddafi, about the idea that is now being bruited about of not only training the rebels, so-called rebels, with CIA operatives apparently now on the ground, but also arming them?
Very interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think we've got a real problem. I think the big story this week was the fact that we have intelligence and special operations people in Libya, along with the Brits on that
boots
score.
On the ground, one might call them.
Yeah, or more appropriately, loafers on the ground, maybe. at least from the intel standpoint. But there was an alarming testimony by the NATO commander Jim Stavridis that. He's seeing flickers of Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah inside the opposition. This is a real danger. There's no question that Al-Qaeda is going to try to pick up the pieces of this instability, not just in Libya, but in other places, Tunisia, Egypt, the entire region. And if the U.S. isn't prepared for that and actually actively opposes that, along with the coalition, we're going to end up with a very, very bad situation.
Yeah, we were talking earlier, Bill Gertz, with Peter Pham about the possibility that Al-Qaeda is already very much moving into the southern parts of Libya that have been vacated by the Gaddafi forces. Them and the Muslim Brotherhood will be watching this closely with your good help, Bill Gertz. As always, thank you for joining us here at Secure Freedom Radio. Keep up that splendid work, and we'll talk again next week. And we'll talk to you, I hope, as well, next week, same time, same station. Until then, thank you so much for listening. This is Frank Gaffney, over and out.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.